Hello there. Today is Tuesday, March 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as the Russia investigation ends, the president lashes out at Democrats.
Those people will certainly be looked at. I've been looking at them for a long time, and I'm saying, why haven't they been looked at? They lied to Congress. Many of them, you know who they are.
Thousands in Mozambique continue to suffer after last week's massive cyclone. Also ahead, celebrations and a new documentary in honor of the Queen of Soul. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump on Monday praised Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who has said to have cleared Trump of collusion with Moscow, but not of possible obstruction of American justice. For nearly 2 years, Trump had repeatedly blasted the special counsel probe as a witch hunt. But despite Mueller's refusal to exonerate Trump, his spokesman and leading Republicans all claimed total vindication for the president. Questioned by reporters, Trump said he welcomed Mueller's results but blasted the investigation for taking place at all.
Those people will certainly be looked at. I've been looking at them for a long time, and I'm saying, why haven't they been looked at? They lied to Congress. Many of them, you know who they are. They've done so many evil things.
On Sunday, Attorney General William Barr released a summary of Mueller's findings from the exhaustive 22-month probe, which led to dozens of indictments as well as guilty pleas from some of Trump's closest former associates. In a letter to congressional leaders, Barr said Mueller concluded that Russia unquestionably meddled in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, but that Trump and his campaign didn't conspire with Moscow to help win the White House. Barr said Mueller reached no conclusion on whether Trump obstructed the federal investigation. And absent a recommendation from Mueller, Barr stepped in and decided there wasn't sufficient evidence to establish that the president obstructed justice. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer urged a Senate vote on a resolution calling for the release of Mueller's report.
It's a simple request for transparency, nothing more, nothing less, not to make a decision as to what you believe, not to say what we ought to do about it, just to make it public.
But Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell objected, blocking a vote, saying Barr must be given time to determine which portions of the report can be divulged without revealing classified information. Joining us to talk more about the investigation and what happens now is Jeremy Mayer, associate professor in the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Jeremy, I know you're not an attorney, but why do you think Special Counsel Robert Mueller decided not to make a decision when it came to the issue of obstruction of justice?
My sense from reading feedback from attorneys and from people who are familiar with the prosecutorial process, obstruction is a really hard prosecution. It's a hard crime to prove. And one of the weird things about the case against Trump is, to the extent that he was very public about doing things in the name of shutting down the investigation, it looks less like obstruction as we traditionally understand it. It's almost as if Richard Nixon was guilty of obstruction because he did it secretly, whereas Trump, by tweeting about it over and over again, made it seem like it was less of a crime and more of just a man who's angry.
And with the summary that we got from Attorney General William Barr, do you believe that Barr's summary was sufficient?
Oh, I absolutely don't think that Barr's summary satisfies the needs of the nation or the needs of the Congress. This is our money that Special Counsel Mueller was spending, and he was our agent. We deserve, within the limit of the law, to get as much of this as we can. And I think, as Democrats are pointing out on the Hill, when the Republicans on the Hill demanded of the FBI that they see hundreds of thousands of pages of the Hillary Clinton investigation, they got them, more than 800,000 pages. And let us recall that that was a similar case where the FBI and Justice Department decided not to prosecute. Well, in this case, Mueller decided not to prosecute, either because he couldn't find evidence or because he believes the president can't be indicted. So Democrats have a really strong case to make that since the FBI turned over all kinds of files on the Clinton case, they should receive a similar amount of material, if not more, on the Trump case.
And with the issue of obstruction, do you think that Mueller actually meant for that decision to be looked over by Congress and not the Attorney General?
Well, we certainly don't know, because the Mueller report is not what we have. We have a four-page summary of a much longer report. And it is entirely possible that Bob Mueller hoped that Congress would make the decision about obstruction. But as of right now, all we have is that Barr said he neither exonerated him, nor did he move to prosecute him. And in Barr's opinion, working with Rosenstein, in less than 48 hours, they determined that there was no prosecution case here for obstruction.
The investigation did acknowledge that Russia interfered successfully into the 2016 presidential campaign. But at this point, still, President Trump has not really acknowledged that. And that, I think, may be one reason why people still have trouble believing things he says regarding Russia. Do you agree?
I think the president has had a problem with saying that all along. I think in part, at least, because of ego. Because if he comes out and says, Russia wanted to elect me, then his great accomplishment, which it was quite an accomplishment, everyone, including me, said Hillary was going to win. And then in one of the great upsets in American history, Trump pulls out a victory. He loves talking about it. And if he even once said, yeah, Russia wanted me to win and they helped, I think within his own self, a little part of his pride would die. And his pride is perhaps Trump's most important value. So that explains for me why he doesn't say it. We also may well find out more about Russia's involvement when we actually see more of the Mueller investigation.
Do you think we will get to see the whole report?
I think eventually we'll see almost all of it. And I think that because Barr is going to be forced to release more, Democrats will subpoena more. And I think Bob Mueller is smart enough in this town and in its ways to find a legal way to say the things that he wants to say if there's things left unsaid. Mueller made a strategic decision to indict people along the way. He probably did that so he could flip them, so he could successfully recruit them for his purposes. That strategy worked as a prosecutorial strategy, but I'm not sure it worked as a political strategy, because we just have this kind of ending with a sense of disappointment on the side of Democrats and a sense of jubilation on the part of Republicans, when in fact, this is one of the most serious prosecutions of a presidential campaign in American history.
That's Jeremy Mayer, associate professor in the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Meanwhile, Mueller did secure guilty pleas or won convictions for a variety of offenses against six Trump aides and advisors, including the president's one-time campaign manager, Paul Manafort, his first national security advisor, Michael Flynn, and his longtime personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. Israeli forces on Monday struck targets across the Gaza Strip, including the offices of Hamas's supreme leader, in response to a surprise rocket attack from the Palestinian territory, as the military bolstered its troops and rocket defense systems in anticipation of a new round of heavy fighting with the Islamic militant group. Israel opened public bomb shelters in most major cities, and civil defense authorities canceled sports events and public transportation in southern Israel. The Israeli army said at least 30 rockets have been fired into Israel as air raid sirens wailed across southern Israel late Monday night. During a White House meeting with President Donald Trump, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel will not tolerate this.
Israel is responding forcefully to this wanton aggression. I have a simple message to Israel's enemies. We will do whatever we must do to defend our people and defend our state.
Late Monday, Hamas announced that a ceasefire had been brokered by Egyptian mediators, but shortly after, renewed rocket fire could be heard in Gaza, setting off air raid sirens in southern Israel. The sudden uptick in violence came as Netanyahu, who is in a tight race for re-election, faces tough criticism from challengers who accuse him of being too soft on Hamas. The violence cut Netanyahu's trip short. He was in Washington to celebrate the U.S. recognition of Israel's control of the Golan Heights. Joining us now to talk more about all of it is Benham Ben Talibu of the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Thank you for being with us. So was the president's decision about Israel's sovereignty in the Golan Heights a good idea in your view?
The president's decision to recognize Israeli full control of the Golan Heights, basically a de jure control, largely stems from the changing security situation in the Middle East, in my view, since the Syrian civil war in 2011. That conflict, which has been on Israel's doorsteps, has in fact made the Iran threat for Israel much more acute. We know that there are Sunni extremists and Iranian proxies just opposite Israel, growing in quantity, growing in lethality. And of course, there's the question of the Assad regime's longevity. What if it's hollowed out? What if it collapses? It's important to note that, of course, that the U.S. Has kind of been alone in this decision. Some key partners, such as the U.K., are continuing to use the term, occupied territory when referring to the Golan. Turkey, a regional player, which has been quite problematic on Syria, but important to note for the future of U.S. military operations in the region, also took a very tough stance against the U.S. position. I think there's a significant implication for the impending Israeli elections, of course, for Bibi Netanyahu, who has been close to the president. That'll be quite significant. But I think in the short term, the administration, whether it's on the Israel embassy move or on pulling out of the Iran deal or now the Golan Heights, has kind of been puncturing a lot of conventional wisdom and myths about what range of opportunities are available to the U.S. and overreactions and underreactions.
Ultimately, do you think that this will help peace or make it more difficult to achieve?
I'm still not sure. I think for me, the jury is still out as an Iran watcher, of course. I have to look at the other threat that Iran is able to pose to Israel, not just from the Golan, but from the north with Lebanese Hezbollah, and of course with the news now of the Gaza rocket strikes. Iran has been a force multiplier for Gaza's rocket capabilities. Gaza gets those rocket capabilities not just from Iran, but from Syria, as well as some homemade stuff. But there is a significant Iranian element now in the Israeli-Palestinian equation, and I think to be able to divorce, to think that one can do peace deal absent changing the regional security situation would be a myth.
Wouldn't it be more difficult, particularly when the U.S. continues to approve of Israel, more credibility to territory that may be disputed?
A great deal depends on how prominent Resolution 242, which called for the quote-unquote withdrawal of the Israeli armed forces from the territories after the 1967 war, how prominent that resolution will play in this larger Trump/Kushner attempt to kind of have a new, larger, ultimate deal peace plan for the region. So the prominence of that resolution would be a bellwether for us to see how much the Golan Heights would matter or not for the administration.
As you mentioned, the rocket attacks, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu cutting his trip to Washington short to go back and deal with this upswing in violence. The surprise rocket attack from the Palestinian territory, what do you think has prompted this? Do you think it was a direct result of this Golan thing? What's your assessment of why the upswing now in all this violence coming back?
Well, I think what Hamas, like many other Iranian proxies are cognizant of, is Israeli domestic politics, is opportunities, of course, to kind of punctuate the Israeli national security narrative, and opportunities to really strike a political blow with military weapons. And I think this is exactly what one of these quite far-flying rockets, about 120, 130 kilometers, depending on how you count, and depending on the actual origin of the launch, was intended to do. It sent a strong signal about Hamas's willingness to continue to use violence against Israeli civilians to make score political points, and perhaps could have even been at the direction of Iran. I don't necessarily think that the Golan front, or a reaction to Golan, was a part of this. Right now we are fortunate that there is a de-escalation of the situation with this Egyptian brokered ceasefire. Hopefully that ceasefire gets to be enforced and stay in place over the evening now. But I think this is opportunism 101, and Hamas, as a proxy of Iran, knows how to exploit and look for opportunities. And moving into the elections, I think they may have wanted to box in the prime minister, but also to score points at the cost of human lives, which fortunately there were none, but there were 7 injured.
The decisions that President Trump is making in the relationship that he has obviously built with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who obviously is facing a tough re-election. Do you think these decisions are sort of mutually being made for domestic or international political reasons?
I still think there are much more strategic considerations here at play, that there's been strong bipartisan U.S. support for Israel both during the Cold War and after the Cold War. A lot of these moves seem to be driven by the regional security situation, but of course the embassy move is one that I think multiple administrations have promised and the Trump administration actually delivered. I think the ultimate test will be the administration's long-awaited peace plan. When it's unveiled, how realistic is it? What role do the U.N. resolutions play in it? And of course, can we actually move towards peace when there is this larger external threat, and that is the Iran and Iran proxy threat?
All right, that's Benham Ben-Talablu of the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. UN launches a $282 million appeal for Mozambique cyclone relief. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the U.S. will not stand idly by as Russia escalates Venezuela tensions. The Chinese leader's visit to Paris is seen as a test for European unity. And Trump critic, lawyer Michael Avenatti, is charged with trying to extort millions from Nike. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Villages in central Mozambique are still waiting to receive aid 10 days after Cyclone Idai hit. 128,000 people are now living in makeshift camps, and health officials say the spread of diseases like cholera are inevitable. Gracie Jerome reports.
At least 700 people have died in Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi. The bridge here was destroyed, cutting off any aid convoys from reaching the village so far. This woman says they have no clothes, no food, and even if they did, they have no pots and pans to cook it in because it was all washed away. Further east in Beira, the aid has arrived, but people are worried for the future. It's not enough just to survive, they say. They need everything rebuilt. The government estimates there are now around 128,000 people living in makeshift camps across the country. Reuters' Stephen Eisenhammer is in Beira.
People are slowly rebuilding the community here, putting up the roofs, trying to rebuild the walls. But the community here is still incredibly affected and incredibly distraught by the tragedy that happened. They say that they weren't really given a proper warning. The government said that they should stay in their homes and not allow their children outside. But the storm here took on such a ferocity that the roofs started being ripped off, the walls started to come down, and people ran in the rain and in the wind to try and seek shelter.
And there's another concern. With limited access to clean water, officials say the spread of disease is inevitable.
There'll be cholera. That's why the government is putting... There will be. The government is putting a prevention and treatment center specific for cholera in the districts affected.
The UN says the water is receding every day, making it easier to rescue those stranded by the floods. But it also means finding more bodies of those who could not escape.
That's Gracie Jerome reporting. In Thailand, voters waited Monday for the results of an election called a return to democratic rule, but which has been widely criticized as an exercise designed by Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha to entrench his military's stranglehold on power. Preliminary official results released late Sunday showed that with 93% of ballots counted, the military-backed party was in the lead. The campaign was marred by allegations of vote buying, however. Complaints were few on polling day, with election observers from Australia, Canada, and the United States, and the 10 members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations on hand. Security was tight, and opinions were mixed, as about 52 million Thais voted. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talked about it with Ian Beard, director of the Center for Southeast Asia Studies at the University of Wisconsin.
There are people that are making various allegations about whether there has been some interference in the vote, you know, double voting or things like this. And the turnout seems to be a lot lower than people expected, which also has raised some questions. These are just allegations at this point, and it's hard to know how much truth is in them. It's still going to take a long time for them to figure out the party vote proportion of the seats. That won't be announced until early May. So there's a lot of speculation right now and uncertainty. It would appear that, you know, on the one hand, the military party has a great advantage because they start off with 250 seats, presumably coming from the unelected members. However, they may require to have a coalition partner, and at this point it's not clear who that might be or if any of the other parties are willing to enter into a coalition with the pro-military party.
What are the problems associated with the military party not winning?
I think either way, there is still going to be a lot of polarizing factors in Thai politics, because the constitution of Thailand is set up in such a way now that it's not really a fully democratic system, because you have one-third of the seats are now given to the military to a point. You know, this is a very uncertain situation right now, because it seems that the same sort of divisions that have been plaguing Thailand for many years are continuing.
There have been some suggestions and some predictions that this might lead to a stronger military takeover, maybe even a violent coup. Have you come to that same conclusion?
I would not say that at this point. You know, there have been some speculation on that front, but I don't think there's enough evidence at this point to say that that is a likely scenario. It really depends on how things play out in the next days and even weeks, because even the Pheu-Thai party may only have 37% of the elected seats, not including the non-elected ones, of the 500 seats that are elected. So that being the case, they're also going to have coalition partners if they were to try to form a government. And I think the Future Forward Party would certainly be an obvious ally. There's still a lot to be determined here.
How strong is the military still in Thailand? This is basically for our listeners and readers who are not following this on an everyday basis.
The military in Thailand is very powerful, and Thailand has the history of a very large number of coups and attempted coups over many decades. And so the military has not simply kept to the barracks and dealt with military affairs. They've often inserted themselves into politics. It is what is happening right now, because they are attempting to convert a government that was based on a military coup into a civilian military government with a new constitution that the military essentially wrote, and which gives the military a major role in politics to try to basically prevent the parties that were in some ways linked to Thaksin Shinawat, who was removed in a coup in 2006, and then later his sister, when she became prime minister afterwards, was also removed in a coup. And so they're trying to prevent their supporters from returning to power.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking to Ian Beards, director of the Center for Southeast Asia Studies at the University of Wisconsin. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka. Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Parts of our oceans routinely go through temperature swings. The El Niño and La Niña effects in the Pacific are perhaps the best known, but new research in Britain suggests that those heat waves are becoming more common and more extreme, and that spells trouble for the world's waters. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
The new research says that while oceans are constantly fluctuating in temperature, these days they are getting hotter a lot more often.
In that 60-year difference, we saw an increase in over 50% of the number of marine heatwave days that you could expect across the globe in any one year.
Dan Smale works for Britain's Marine Biological Association. He says that while marine heatwaves aren't uncommon, they're becoming more common because in many places, climate change is raising the average temperature of ocean water.
There's natural fluctuations in temperature in the oceans and the atmosphere. But when they happen now, because of background global warming and ocean warming, when they happen, they tend to occur in regions that have become much warmer in recent decades, and so the starting point for these events is much hotter than it used to be.
The result is that the plants and animals that live in these areas are having trouble dealing with the increased heat.
Where the heat waves are really intense or really long-lasting, then we've seen large-scale die-offs of these foundation species and consequent changes in entire ecosystems.
Seagrass and kelp are particularly sensitive, and like coral reefs, these kelp forests are huge islands of biodiversity. And when they get stressed, the whole system suffers.
We've seen in the Mediterranean, where they've lost loads of seagrass, huge changes in biodiversity and ecosystem structure. And similarly in Australia, on both the east and the west coast, we've seen large-scale loss of kelp forest habitat, marine forests, and that's led to large-scale losses of biodiversity and changes in function.
The solution, of course, is to stop the climate change that is driving the warming.
If we really want to mitigate the effects of these marine heat waves, we need to quite urgently reduce greenhouse gas emissions and move away from a carbon-based economy.
Seaweed and kelp also act as carbon sinks, soaking up a lot of the excess carbon we're pumping into the atmosphere. So keeping these forests intact, Smale says, is a big part of fighting climate change. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Family members celebrated Aretha Franklin on what would have been the Queen of Soul's 77th birthday Monday with a memorial service and a screening of a documentary film. The service was held inside a chapel at Woodlawn Cemetery in Detroit. Franklin's niece, Sabrina Owens, said the family thought it might be a good idea to start the day in prayer. In addition to Owens, Franklin's sons were among those who attended the remembrance service, which focused not only on the legendary singer, but also other departed family members, including Aretha's father and her brother. And later Monday, the Detroit Institute of Arts was hosting the premiere of Amazing Grace, which chronicles Franklin's 1972 performance at a Los Angeles church. Owens said the film will go into wider release next month. And she said that while the movie and the recent release of a box set of recordings from that performance are reasons to celebrate, the loss of her aunt still stings. Franklin died last year after battling pancreatic cancer and was laid to rest inside a crypt not far from Woodlawn's chapel. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Together, that's how it must be to live without you. Would only mean heartbreak for me. That's how it must be to live without you. Would only be heartbreak for me.
This is VOA News. I'm Tom.